Hello, everybody. Jace here. Before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to remind everyone of a couple of the episodes we released recently of particular note. I wrote an article, didn't release a comic source episode on it, but there are some clips in the article, and it's all about the new Lost in Space Netflix series that debuted Friday, April 13th. On Netflix, and something pretty funny happened to me when I was covering the panel and the press room for that series, and it's all explained in the article. As I said, I've gotten a lot of good feedback about the article, so I just wanted to let you all know about that. And then at the press room after, you know, talking to the cast, it's very apparent that they're all heavily invested in the series. I think that the series is excellent. I think everyone should watch it. I think it's very much a family show in keeping with one theme that was pretty prevalent in the original series. And that, again, is the theme of family. So I'm going to play a little snippet from one of the cast members here, Molly Parker, who plays Maureen Robinson. And I'll put a link in the show notes to the article so you can go check it out for yourself.
And you know, it's funny, we didn't talk that much about like, oh, we're doing something different because these women are strong. I mean, I have played a number of strong women in my career, and one of the things that, for me, just feels really good about the show is that none of it is spoken about, you know? No one talks about the fact that our daughter is mixed race. Nobody talks about the fact that this woman can do whatever this man can do. Like, we've all been trained, we all have the capacity, we can do what needs to be done.
The other thing that I want to mention, Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe, the web series is finally going to be released on April 21st, this coming Saturday. I recently had a chance to sit down and talk with Aaron Shanka, who is the director and one of the producers from Bat in the Sun. And he has worked very, very hard on this project. He's really proud of it. So we're trying to spread the word and make sure when it debuts on Saturday on comicbook.com that it blows up everywhere. So again, a quick snippet from Aaron talking about the show.
And it's like, it's just kind of strange. Like, I've heard directors say like, the colorful costumes don't work on screen, so we just ditch that. And I'd be like, well, it's your job to make them work. That's, you know, those are the characters that we love. So, and like you're saying, like, as far as the cockiness and as far as the costumes and the look, everything is attention to detail. I mean, the personalities are different. The way that the actors look are different. The way they fight are different. You know, there's so many defining things. I try to think of it sometimes as if I'm like adapting, or making a movie about George Washington or Lincoln. People who really existed, to where you don't have that creative license to change it. It's just what it is, because, you know, Lincoln looked a certain way. He talked a certain way. He conducted himself a certain way. And when they make a movie, they have to subscribe to that. And I think that when you're doing superheroes, you should do that, because that is why they have resonated for so long. I mean, the blueprint for why Superman, Batman, Spider-Man work, you know, that's been around for 50 to 80 years. And I don't know why you'd want to change that.
All right. So I encourage you all to definitely check out Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe when it comes out this coming Saturday. And also go back if you want more information and listen to our Valiant Sunday episode when we had Aaron on and talked all about the series. So now on to the episode, everybody. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace, and this is a spotlight episode on Journey, which is my favorite title that comes out from Aspen Comics. And I'm lucky enough to have with me tonight the writer of Journey, someone who I think doesn't get enough credit for just how talented of a writer he is. You may know him from things like Green Arrow when it relaunched with the New 52, or
Captain Atom, criminally underrated run. And now he's writing Journey for Aspen. It's JT Kroll. JT, thanks for coming on the show again, man.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's always great to have you on. So,
way too many accolades to start out the show, though. So you really, you know, you need to dial that down a little bit.
All right, fair enough.
I have a small office. My head's going to get too big. I'll have to go out in the other room.
You know you're one of my favorite people, man. I can't help it. So let's jump right into Journey. We'll talk at the end about some of your other work. But let's jump in with Journey. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar, can you give us kind of the elevator pitch, what it's all about?
Yeah, let's see. These are always hard for me to do, the elevator pitch ones. Journey is a magical fantasy adventure in the vein of all just everything that's classic and awesome about fantasy and adventure. It centers around a warrior princess named Aura who discovers that she is half djinn, half genie, and she embarks on an epic quest to find her mother, who is a full genie, a djinn, when she is kidnapped by an evil sorcerer. So that's the genesis for kind of her quest, if you will. And it's just this rollicking, like, epic adventure for her to explore these uncharted territories and new worlds that are completely foreign to her as she tries to ultimately find and rescue her mother.
Yeah, and the reception's obviously been pretty good. Your Volume 3, Issue 2, comes out this Wednesday, April 18th.
Yes.
So three volumes, and the reception's been pretty good then.
Yeah, we've been really excited about it. It was initially came out as part of Aspen's 10th anniversary, as part of the 10 for 10. And Paula Pantalena was on the penciler for the first volume. And then we had V. Ken Marion for Volume 2 a few years ago. And now we have Michael Santamaria joining us for Volume 3. And yeah, no, I'm thrilled that that people seem to like it. And I'm, you know, in the world of comics, there's, you know, that ultimate benchmark is just the ability to be able to keep writing the comic you want to write. And so to be able to do that and keep telling more stories in the world of Journey, you really can't ask for anything more. I mean, that's the whole goal, is just to be able to keep telling the stories.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason it's resonated is a couple of the themes that are really kind of central to the story are things that we can all relate to. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but just for the benefit of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar, you know, we're not going to spoil too much for you guys. I want you to go out and pick up these volumes or the individual issues and discover the world for yourself. But just to give a quick overview or a synopsis, we're really in the first volume kind of dropped right into the action. It picks up right away with an invading army, kidnapping Aura's mother, who's a full djinn, a full genie, as JT mentioned. And really from there, it's Aura on this quest to rescue her mother. But kind of underneath that surface layer, JT, it's kind of about building character and discovering this world you've created, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. When I talked about it kind of being, the foundation of it or the inspiration for it in all things fantasy, it really was kind of born from my love of things like Lord of the Rings and really Conan the Barbarian and Conan in general was a big thing. What I loved about the tales of Conan, both the short stories and the comic books and the movie as well, is that you basically have a lone character wandering this wild landscape and encounters all these amazing places and people and dangers and conflicts. And it's about how we kind of are exposed to this world through that character's eyes. And so being able to have Aura be our guide, if you will, and be able to watch her interact with all these different aspects of the world around her and see how she responds to things and how all of her actions and essentially reveal her character along the way. That was really kind of a key driving point for the story, even going back to the very first issue.
Yeah. And how far along in Volume 1 was it before you realized you really had, like, captured something and you were going to have a Volume 2? Did it happen right away or a few issues?
I think it was a few issues in. I mean, you know, the response was always really powerful and really positive, which was great. But again, you know, in the world of independent comics, you never know, you know, how it's gonna last. You know, people can love a book and still not buy it. So right. You have to have people buying the book in order to be able to make it. So it was probably halfway through because of the 10 for 10 promotion that Aspen did, which was fantastic. Every first issue for every book was only $1. So it helped expose the book to a lot of new readers right out of the gate. And so it was just a matter of seeing once the price point went to a regular price point, and as the story, you know, as the further issues came off, because as you would know as well as I, there's this that natural attrition from the first issue to the second issue. And then, you know, as the issue kind of settles, the story kind of settles in and the sales kind of settle into a kind of an equilibrium for the book. So it was about midway through the first that we knew that it was definitely doing well. And it was always built with the intention of having another volume, obviously, and not to spoil anything, but the ending itself really is, the ending of the first volume was one of the first things I realized I knew was going to be the end of the first volume, was that kind of image and to kind of let the reader know that like the title suggests, it is all about her journey. And so that is kind of the story. And so we knew it was going to be a long ride for her.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question. If you changed it at all, if you had a different resolution in mind, if maybe the sales weren't there.
No, I never did. And again, it kind of goes back to, you see it a little more, I think, in the second volume, this kind of notion of, I guess, the Conan structure. What I tried to do with the second volume is I built a tapestry, if you will, where all the issues fed into one another, and there's this building sense of drama and conflict. And so it was all connected. But really, in the second volume, each issue was its own story. Like, it was, they're designed to be self-contained stories with beginning, middles, and ends, as she's in another part of the world with the Captain Boro, and she's experiencing, again, all new places and new civilizations and creatures and characters and whatnot. So that was always kind of a key thing for me. Again, going back to that traditional fantasy notion of having these more contained stories, as we have this character kind of navigating through it, as opposed to one overarching storyline that's going to have a beginning, middle, and an end.
Yeah, I really feel like you, and maybe it's just because I'm so partial to Vikan's art. You know, he's such an incredible artist, but I really feel like you guys raised the bar with volume two. The art was spectacular. The characters. So not to spoil too much, listeners, but Ara ends up on a pirate ship. And the characters there are so colorful and so full of life, you know, especially the captain. And then the kind of the twist partway through that you don't see coming, which ties into some of the themes that we'll talk about later. So did you really feel like after the first volume you had a good handle on art at that point, and you were able to just build on what had come before as much as building out the world and adding to her and fleshing her out as a realistic character?
Absolutely. I kind of had her down pretty quickly. The one thing that I find myself reflecting upon, and it actually just happened in an issue two that comes out next week, is this kind of the violence that she takes part in. Because she's really does live in this brutal kind of world. Like, it's really kind of a Conan-esque harsh world of, you know, she mentions it in one of the issues in the third volume. And I think I also touched upon it in the previous volume, was this notion of, you know, there's blood and steel. That's really all there is in this world, you know? And in the very first issue, the very first caption, she's talking about, she's trying to rescue these creatures from these kind of barbarian horde monsters that are going to eat them, essentially. And she's talking about how the world is made up of two people, you know, like the hunters and the prey, if you will. And the those that are killed are those that kill. And so I find myself with her still kind of straddling that line, because she's very, she's got a very high sense of morality in the sense of right and wrong. And she, in that regard, her compass, if you will, is really well grounded and locked for her. Like, she knows who she is, she knows right and wrong, and she definitely tries to stand the line. But at the same time, again, it's not going to spoil anything, but she lashes out at some people, and she makes a comment along, and I never can remember my dialogue exactly, but she talks about how, you know, how she never enjoys killing people, but sometimes it's, sometimes depending on who she has to kill, it's easier. It may, they make it easier for her.
Right.
Like if they're, you know, because they're so, if they're so horrible. So in that regard, you know, kind of her personality kind of ebbs between almost like a Wonder Woman kind of mentality and a Red Sonja or Conan-esque one, which seems like really far into the spectrum. But again, she's a product of her world. And so she's doing what she needs to do in order to either protect herself or protect others and continue on her quest to find her mom.
Yeah. And so if we look at volume one as kind of an introduction to the characters and discovering the world, and volume two gave us, you know, more settings and fleshed out the world more and gave us more insight into who Aura was. I've read the second issue of volume three just today, actually. And what I'm kind of seeing is that you're kind of broadening the supporting cast. Is that kind of where the story goes from here? Now that you've got kind of got the world established in the setting, it's introducing more characters.
Yes, but also it's for a very specific purpose. She's definitely coming into contact with. There's definitely more Jin in this third volume as Aura is on her quest, and she kind of is encountering things on her end. And then also we're spending more time with her mother, Luna, in captivity with Tornthal, who we really didn't touch upon at all on the second volume, except for one small scene, which was basically just kind of a tease to kind of lay the groundwork for what we were going to explore in the third volume. So the third volume really is a culmination volume that's going to answer a lot of questions and resolve a lot of conflicts, but also lay the groundwork moving forward. But it is definitely a big, you know, there is, you know, I don't like to say there's an ending in the third volume that could be an ending, but it, in a way it could be. But again, for the sense that the whole notion, again, of the genesis of the book and the title itself, Journey, being this, you know, the journey is the destination kind of thing, R is going to basically discover and become who she's meant to be based on what she experiences and in the encounters that she has. You know, the world will shape her in that regard. So, but the third volume definitely has a pretty big, meaty storyline that ties in with her and her mother and Tornthal and really pushing that storyline and bringing it to a head.
So here's what I loved about issue two. We're, as you said, a lot more djinns in this third volume. And what's interesting is, so there's so many times in fantasy literature where djinns are characters where they're kind of one dimensional, right? They're kind of all these all powerful beings and they're kind of all the same. And you know, rub the lamp or whatever it is that they're, you know, that they live in, and they come out and they grant the wishes. And they're, like I said, they're just very one dimensional. They don't really have personalities, and one is the same as the other. What was so awesome about issue two is we, you know, we meet these different djinns, and they're all so different. They're all so unique. How'd you come up with the idea like that? They're basically people, and they're as individual as any human. Was that like right from the start, or did it happen organically?
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, there's nothing fun about writing one dimensional characters.
Right.
It's just pretty boring, and it ends up just being like filler. And I would be remiss if I said no one ever wrote one dimensional characters, and I have written one dimensional characters, because sometimes you need a character that serves a very specific purpose, and they're kind of a one and done, and they're, you know, a pirate or a barbarian or, you know, a monster. Like sometimes you just have those things. It's kind of like a car chase in an action movie. Sometimes you just have a car chase because you need a car chase, and
yep.
You don't really, might not have it all explained out why, and it may go on for 20 or 50 minutes depending on who's directing it, but you know, it's there. But no, absolutely. And in fact, I think part of the reason is because the djinn, at least the way I'm trying to approach them, is kind of like taking the mythological fairy tale notion of what a djinn is, a genie, and using that as a foundation, but making it kind of different. You know, I mean, they're like, they are djinn in this world, but they don't necessarily act as real djinn do in again, in the fairy tale notion of like what was somewhat like, you know, there's no Robin Williams Aladdin, you know, a right. genie in here for it. But even the way their powers work, because the way their powers are, it's not a matter of like they don't grant wishes, they just obey. And so it's not like the way the jinn are presented in the world of Journey is that it's not as if someone who controls one can say, I want, you know, all the treasure in the world, that they're going to get all the treasure in the world, like magically poof, appear before them. It's more about they're slaves with tremendous powers and abilities that will do the bidding of whoever possesses them in order to achieve their ends. But it's not, again, it's not like a wish fulfillment. There's no three wishes. There's no magic in that regard. It's if someone wishes to have their enemies, you know, driven out, then the jinn can take an active role as on the battlefield and help make that happen. And part of the reason, the reason you talk about the jinn all being different is because they've all had different experiences. So it's almost like taking these creatures were in a whole nother realm and they were exiled from their celestial realm of Alavon. And so they are sent down to this world and journey to be slaves, it's their punishment for kind of going against the celestial laws of their realm. And so how they are and what they end up being on this realm is predicated by the kind of experiences they have, again, based on who finds them. Luna, Ara's mother, and we touch upon this in the first volume, was found by a very benevolent king, you know, and so he didn't abuse her and he tried not to use her. And if he did it for the good of his kingdom and for the good of his people. And it wasn't like he made her kill a bunch of people or, you know, try to steal jewels and gold and whatnot. And so he was actually going to let her go because that's the way a jinn gets freed. And I guess still borrowing on the fairy tale notion, a jinn can still be freed if their vessel is destroyed, which is extremely hard to do, or if they are given their freedom by whoever possesses it. And so before the king Warwick, who is the one who initially found Ara's mom, found Luna's vessel, he basically had one last wish or desire for Luna, and that was to protect his son, who was a baby. And so what happens and again, this is spoiling a little bit, but this is all stuff covered in the first volume, is that Luna sticks around to protect the son and ends up falling in love with him as he grows into an adult and ends up marrying him. And he never knows that Kennick, the son, he never knows that she's a jinn. Like, he just thinks she's somebody that grew up as like a friend of the family, or like somebody that he was, you know, that lived in the kingdom and that was a close friend for him growing up, and that they grew up together and then they end up getting married.
Yeah, it's a really cool idea when you think about it. And the fact that Ara is half human, half jinn, there's definitely differences between her and the other jinn that make her unique and interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit before we get into the themes of the all three volumes, really, about working with Michael Santamaria. How has that collaboration been?
It's been great. You know, I the one thing with Aspen and working on any Aspen book is they're always really good at finding and mining great new talent. You know, we kind of joke sometimes and it's not always funny, is we're like the AAA league when it comes to artists, because a lot of artists will cut their teeth with Aspen and get on a book with us and they'll do fantastic work. And they show that they can do sequentials, they can do covers, they can hit deadlines, and they get a good body of work to show as a showcase for their talent. And then that draws the attention of, you know, the bigger companies like Marvel and DC, who then, you know, kind of basically steal them away in theory because they can offer them, you know, higher rates and, you know, bigger exposure. Because let's face it, you know, a Journey book isn't going to have the same kind of reach as, say, a Batman book or a Wonder Woman book per se. Michael's doing a great job. Like, we're really excited to have him. I love that all the volumes look very different. You know, it kind of helps me stretch as a writer to work with different artists because I see where their strengths are. And it's almost a challenge to then kind of tweak a story or write it in a way that's going to let them shine and bring everything that they can to the table. It's almost like you're a manager of a coach of a team, like a football team or a hockey team. I use hockey because that's my favorite sport, and bringing a new player on. And so you have to really evaluate that player to see where they really fit the best and whatnot. So Aspen's always been really great. Vince and Frank, in particular, of finding new artists that we can come on and that feel like they'd make a good fit for the book. And Michael has a very clean and classic style. And he, in a way, he reminds me the most of like the old Conan comic books that I read growing up. You know, I mean, it's kind of got that, just the paneling and the way it breaks down. It's a very clear, straightforward style. And don't get me wrong, everybody's done a great job on the previous volumes, but it's just a matter of, again, like just kind of having that where, like, for instance, V. Ken, you know, he's just, you know, amazing in a lot of regards. And he was really good with like very expressive on the faces and like drawing big wide shots. And so, I remember for him, there's this great image in volume two where Aro is with Boro on the pirate ship and they're going to this new land and it's called, you know, this big island that's really just kind of this black obelisk rock growing up out of the middle of the ocean. And I'll never forget, like, it was one of my favorite images of the volume. And it's, you know, essentially just a big picture of the ocean with this big rock sticking up. But in terms of how I thought of the book and how the settings were characters in their own right, you know, almost like a James Bond movie with locales being so important to the world of James Bond. Like in a fantasy book, like the environment plays such a big role in it. And he just nailed that imagery so perfectly. Like he drew exactly what I was thinking of. And I actually bought the piece from him, the original pencils from it, because I loved it so much. And so, like I said, every artist kind of brings their flair to it. And Michael's doing a fantastic job. He's a newer guy. And you know, we're hard at work on the next issue right now. And, you know, every artist, like the more they work, the better they get. And you can see that his issue three stuff is better than his issue one stuff. But for him in that first issue, that first initial image of Aro, when she's kind of just in these kind of regular clothes she's carrying a big sack of wheat over her shoulder because she's living with this village and kind of helping them out. Like it really struck a Wonder Woman chord with me. Like you can almost see, like if you colored it differently, that it could be, you know, Diana in some village someplace helping some people out. Like it just kind of had, and that angle he chose, and it was strong and powerful, but not like in your face. And it was subdued yet powerful and very classic in that regard. And I loved it. I loved that. That was great.
Yeah. I think that for me, V. Ken, you know, his lines are a little, you know, in comparison to Michael, his lines are a little finer. His art's a little more kinetic. It suggests a little more movement to me. Whereas Michael, mm-hmm. like you said, there's a real like strength. There's a real solidity to his art. So I can definitely see what you're talking about with, you know, those classic Conan tales. You know, the lines are a little thicker and it's like the string, you know, it's like there, it's real solid and firm. And yeah, I think for a newer guy, you know, I wasn't familiar with his work, but I've been pretty impressed with what I've seen so far. So kudos to Michael for sure.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Yeah. And we got John Starr on colors, which you can never go wrong with John Starr because he's awesome. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into some of the themes that we've been teasing everybody that we're gonna talk about. For me, the two big themes are belonging. And then, of course, free will, which is always a theme when you're talking about djinns and genies being controlled by somebody. And as we touched on already, you know, as long as you can care about them, which I think you can fall into that trap of making a djinn as a character one dimensional, like we talked about, and then not really caring one way or the other whether they have free will. That's certainly not the case here. But let's touch on the belonging aspect first, because in a way, it's not only an aspect of Journey or Aura's self, because, you know, she discovers in the first volume that she's not all human, but she's really not all djinn either. And she doesn't know a lot about, you know, that world that her mother came from. And right away, you know, she's questioning, well, where do I fit in? Where do I belong? And then that's mirrored also in the story of the djinns who've been cast out into this world that they don't belong. And again, I find it interesting that Luna chose to stay, because for the most part, all of them seem to just want to get back home where they quote unquote belong. So, I'm sure that was, you know, as you conceived of the story, that was something that you wanted to explore, something that we can relate to as readers, because, you know, as humans, we're always trying to find a place to belong, right?
Yeah, I think, and this may be revealing my Catholic upbringing, but I went to a Catholic elementary school and I was an altar boy, so I'm well versed in all of that. And so I think it's this notion, the jinn are not angels, but if you think about this notion of angels and that desire or almost the envy that they may have over humans because of what they're able to experience, there is a little bit of that notion in there, of Luna couldn't experience having Aura and the love she felt for her husband and the king in her realm. And we touch upon it a little bit, and you're actually going to see some of it play out more in this third volume of like what that realm is really like and what existence there is really like and how it's very different than down here. You think about something like Star Trek: The Next Generation, where you have like a storyline where, Data gets to experience emotions. And it's that notion of like, well, yes, you get to experience love and joy and happiness, but you also get to experience pain and envy and loss, So it is that notion of, we are blessed and cursed with this ability to feel things in our world. In a way, the jinn kind of play in that, building on both of what you're talking about, the belonging and the free will, and talking about this notion of the jinn not being one dimensional, is that Anjaha, who is the main, like Torrenthal's main bad jinn, if you will, from the first volume, he is presented at first almost like a one-dimensional one, but I put a very little kind of scene in the beginning, and then when the scene plays out towards the end of the first volume, I'll ask, since you read it, did you expect his reaction to be that, or did you think something else was going to come upon?
No, I didn't expect it, because as you said, when he first appears, he just seems like, kind of like he's just the strong guy, right? He does come across as one dimensional, almost like he to touch upon the other theme, he doesn't have free will. He's just doing the bidding. And then when that happens, that's like kind of eye opening, and you realize, oh, wait, this guy's not right. Doing what he wants. He's not just a tool. He's not just a hammer that Torrenthal
pulls
out.
He is a slave, and he is a product of who is possessing him. And it's Torrenthal's anger and hatred, which we will also learn more about, kind of the genesis for that and why Torrenthal, what his motivation is and why he's doing what he's doing and why he's kind of gathering these different jinn around and what his deal is with regard to that. But that notion of, and this may spoil a little bit of volume one, but hey, it's been out a long while and we have to talk about something. So the notion of Anjab, which was, when he is finally freed, like he just lets go. Like there's nothing there. There is no hate or sense of revenge. And Aura is actually surprised because she expects him to go nuts and payback time for Torrenthal and all he's put him through. And it's just not there. Like, again, this notion of the realm that they're from is kind of detached from things like that, from those, earthly concerns, if you will, of like revenge and love and hate and whatnot. And so, and all, like I said, all he wants is to go home, and that is for the most part, that is kind of the thing, because this is their exile. This is their purgatory in a way.
Yeah. And we have to give Apollo some props for that panel too, because as he's looking up in the sky, I mean, it's so obvious on his face, because again, yeah, when he first shows up, you don't think of him as having any emotion other than maybe anger, because again, he's just that hammer that Torrenthal's going to use to hit the nail. And so for him to have, that expression on his face, with the longing, really is the way to put it.
He did a great job on that. That was great. It was one of my favorite scenes of the volume, because again, it's not what you expect, and it goes to the heart of the book, and it's not action. Don't get me wrong, I love action, but like, those are the moments. It's the quiet character moments are the ones that I always find myself more drawn to when doing anything like that. And that one really hit spot on, I thought.
And what is the challenge in exploring free will? I mean, it's so easy to fall into tropes, right? I mean, the whole concept of free will is something that
that I think a lot of different fiction, you know, explores. So kind of what's the line you walk to try to present something interesting?
I kind of get a little bit of a easier time of it because of the nature of the djinn and the fact that they're forced into it. So free will is more of a harsher line because I think we're covering it in such a direct fashion that these are people who are literally slaves who cannot defy the will of those who possess them. And we even do play on this notion of there's different levels of being under control by Torrenthal or whomever possesses the vessel that they're connected with. You know, there's a scene in the first volume where, you know, Torrenthal is almost like torturing or testing, if you will, Luna and trying to break her basically. And we have other elements like that playing out in this third volume to fully make that transition over. But in a way, you know, I guess in that regard, it's free will, but I think I'm also kind of touching upon notions of just fate. And can fates be changed, or is fate inevitable? Because when you're dealing with fantasy and magic, a lot of times fate kind of comes into play, or prophecies and, you know, destiny, if you will. And I have this, and we may have talked about this last time I saw you. I feel like there is this evolution of destiny happening, from a generational standpoint. And what I mean by that is when I grew up and the stories that I grew up with, you think of two people in particular, Luke Skywalker and Harry Potter, right? Two amazing characters in two different amazing universes, that really connected with society and pop culture and culture and humanity in general. Both characters who are unique individuals that are destined for something great, right? It's preordained that they are their purpose. You know, Harry Potter has the scar, like he's the boy that would not die. And he's marked and he's special and he's destined to face and overcome, you know, the great evil. Luke Skywalker, it also seems to be destined to have that confrontation with Darth Vader and face the Force head on and whatnot. And then I feel like, in recent memory, we have these examples of stories where it's not somebody who's destined for anything particular. It's just somebody who's put in a particular place and kind of given the opportunity to succeed or fail or thrive or win or lose, you know, where they're not, you know, like, again, going with the Luke and Harry Potter, you think about Neo from The Matrix, right? Again, this kind of whole notion of the chosen one. Well, I feel like, in even recent movies, like the new Blade Runner comes to instance where you think, and I'm going to spoil it if you haven't seen it. You've seen it, Jace, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay, it's been long enough, and we have to talk about something. So, but learning that that Kay is not the child, right? I mean, that's a huge moment in that story, and it starts to affect his journey, but ultimately he makes the decision to keep going, you know, even though he knows he's not the quote chosen one, that he's not the special one. And if you think about it also, going back to Star Wars, you have Rey, who we assume is, like, again, connected somehow and destined. And unless they're going to completely erase what happened in the last movie, yep, which, you know, apparently they could, because weird things happen. But like Rian Johnson goes out of his way to basically say, like, no. She's, you know, it's the Force is special and it's how people react to it. The person isn't she's not destined for anything. And you have that great scene at the end of the movie where the boy's cleaning up the, you know, sweeping, and he reaches out and the broom goes into his hand and, like, oh my God, like, it could be anybody. And it's, so it's not about how, it's not about who your parents are or where you were born or your genetics. It's about you inside, in terms of, like, what you decide to do with the life you have. And so I think it really kind of changes this notion of, like, you know, notions of hero and destiny and all this sort of stuff. And it's funny because Ara is exactly that. I mean, yes, she's kind of this hybrid. So she's a unique individual. So she's got this unique connection to both worlds. But at the end of the day, she's just a person, you know, and she's carving her own path, and she is going to build her own destiny in a way based on the journey that she's on. And that was a really long answer, but that's kind of the tapestry. If I step back and, you know, look at things from 1,000 feet away, that's how I see things.
No, I mean, I agree with you 100%. And I don't know if it's maybe something in the zeitgeist of where we are, you know, as a culture right now, but I see that happening. It's not so much as, yeah, you're destined or you're fated and you don't have a choice. It's more about somebody who is just maybe an average Joe that steps up, right? That's put in that situation. And that's what's heroic about it, right? There's nothing particularly special about them, but yet they'll rise to the occasion. And I wonder, I read a book recently. I had Michael Morisi. I don't know if you know Michael, on the show recently, but, his first novel, Black Star Renegades, which is kind of a love letter to Star Wars, is very much that. It's very much one person is destined to quote unquote save the universe, and then it just doesn't quite turn out that way, and somebody else has to step up. So
I'm writing the title right now, Black Star Renegades.
Black Star Renegades.
Put a star next to that.
Yes.
I always look for good stuff to read.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and I think those stories, like I think what you're saying, I think the zeitgeist and the kind of the cultural tones that we're going through, I think there is something to that. And I think that, you know, we want to believe that anybody can do anything, as opposed to thinking that you have to be kind of preordained for something, you know? I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, you have to look no further than like the Parkland kids, you know? It's right. I mean, they were, you know, living their lives of normalcy or relative normalcy, whatever you want to call it. And then this horrific thing happened, and what they have kind of, how they've evolved and what they've become walking out of that. Like it's remarkable. Like it's absolutely remarkable, because I don't know any of them personally, but I can guarantee you that a lot of them probably didn't think about politics at all before that. You know, they were just living their life. And all of a sudden, because of this traumatic and unbelievable incident that happened, like their lives are forever altered in a horrific way, but also just in a very profound way. And it's how they're choosing to react. And that's nothing but saying that anybody else who was a survivor of gun violence isn't totally justified to just go on and live their lives, which they totally are. But you have these people who have responded in a certain way, and it's all based on a decision and a reaction that they had to the world around them. And I think that, you know, again, you know, going back to the book and the whole name of the book itself, Journey, is this notion of Ara is defined by what she does. And we, as we all are, we're all defined by the decisions we make in the heat of the moment, in certain situations. You know, if you're presented with bullying in front of you, and do you step up and say something, or do you kind of let it go and do you kind of stay in the background? Like, you know, if there's an accident nearby, are you the type of person that gets in and help, or do you kind of stand on the sidelines? Like, you know, we make 1,000 decisions every day of our lives, and each one of them has the potential to affect, you know, our lives and the lives of people around us. And it's just that, you know, it's again, it's all about that path that we take, and, you know, and where, you know, how it defines who we are. Cause that's all we are. We're all just a collection of our experiences.
Yeah. And really for Ara, you know, this decision to kind of, without any particular information or a wealth of information about her, you know, heritage as a djinn or what her particular powers are, it's the love for her mother that's kind of the motivation that she just chooses to kind of dive in head first. And as you said, it's you know, the duality there, Journey, and, you know, her name, her djinn name, if you will, and versus the journey she's taking. But really, she's also on a journey of growth, right? I mean, she's discovering her heritage, she's discovering her powers, and she's discovering the larger world and the injustices that are out there, and how she can, as you said, make decisions that affect other people's lives.
Right. And sometimes I'm guilty of understating certain things, and because I kind of try to go with that notion of less is more. And sometimes I see other books and they put things out in a way more straightforward way. And so a lot of times I like to just kind of let kind of stuff lie there. And if people get it, then they do. But like, in the first volume, if you go back and look at it, there is this notion of she lived a sheltered life growing up, right? And her mom tried to keep her safe because that was one of her things. She wanted to protect her in their kingdom. And Ara's motivation is less about finding her mother for herself than it is about finding the queen for her kingdom and the queen for her father. Like, she sees how her father's broken because of what happened, and she sees how the kingdom is struggling. And so part of what sends her on this quest is this notion. And I think I drop a few more hints, or she mentions this, which is, it's all about this notion about, you know, I promised them I would bring their queen back, you know, and I'm going to do that, because she thinks that, and again, it's the only home she ever knew, because she never really traveled much. And that's why the journey is also very important to her, because, and the concept of the journey and the title and whatnot, is because she's never been beyond those realms. And so for her, what she's doing is something she's wanted to do, but maybe been scared to do or wasn't able to do her whole life, which is go explore the greater world outside. But now, instead of just going on a vacation to do it, she's on a really purposeful mission. But that's her goal. Her goal isn't just to find her mom so she can find her mom. Her goal is to find her mom so she can return the queen to the kingdom, to save the kingdom. It's almost like the kingdom has there's a little bit of a Fisher King myth in it, where a motif in it, where like the kingdom is hurting, is sick and ailing. And what's going to make it better is to have the queen return, because she was a special source of inspiration and energy and life and love and vitality that is missing. You know, it's the heart. It's like she was and I think I say this in the second volume, there's like a little flashback scene, and it's like the heart of the kingdom is gone, is missing. And that's what she wants to return to it.
And it's interesting you chose a female protagonist. Did you conceive it that way completely from the beginning, or was there ever, which way should I go? Did you want to write something with a female as a
No, character? I've been writing the last few creator-owned things I've done, the Journey book and also my Lost Spark novels, were purposely female characters, partially and due in large part by the fact that I have two girls. And so, I wanted to create a character that in Ara that they could be excited about and look up to and feel would be kind of a good role model or a good representation, because that's what I, again, there's a little bit of that Wonder Woman aspect to her. You know, she's righteous, she's just, she's compassionate in this world that seems to lack compassion, and also she is kind of a woman out of time, because, and you've read them, so you could probably tell that like women aren't treated very well in most of the world that she comes into contact with.
No.
And that's a purposeful thing, is that the way women are, the way females are kind of positioned in these societies, in this world, is very deliberate, because my daughters, I remember one of our favorite movies watching with them is Pride and Prejudice, and they've read the book and I've read the book and seen the movie dozens of times or whatever. And my oldest said to me one time, she said, "Oh, I wish I could live in that time. It seems like it'd be so great." And I had to remind her, I'm like, "Yes, it's a beautiful time." I said, "But you know, the reason that they're struggling and feeling like they have to jockey for position and get married is because they're not allowed to own land." And I go, "And the reason, and they can't own land, and they're worried because none of them are married, or and none of them are boys, none of them can inherit the land, and so it's going to go to this cousin, Mr. Collins, who's going to basically control their destiny because they're not allowed to do this." So they couldn't own property, they couldn't vote, they couldn't really hold jobs. So I had explained to her this notion of like, well, yes, it's nice in a way, but you know, there are certain aspects of it that aren't as grand if you're a woman.
Yeah, and I appreciate that too, because as you know, I have a young daughter, and I'm glad it's changing. I'm glad it's changing. And I don't know if you heard at all of the new Lost in Space that just came out on.
No, I mean, I've heard of it. I haven't seen it though. On Netflix,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Netflix. I was lucky enough to meet some of the cast at WonderCon, and very powerful female characters. So definitely,
oh good,
definitely recommend it for you and your definitely a family show. And I think your girls would dig it.
Yeah, I think they're living in a really golden age. I think women are really, you know, on the forefront of a lot of different avenues. I mean, you look at like the success of the Wonder Woman movie, and you look at, you know, just different characters in fiction and in TV and film and in books, but also just in the real world in general. You know, you've kind of got this whole movement going on in I think there's like 450 women running for public office in the next election coming up, you know, which is unheard of. You know, this is like astronomically more, you know, than ever had done at one time. And so I think that, you know, this notion of seeing women being able to do anything and how everything is kind of within reach to them, I think, and being able to have a character who is powerful and female and also independent, you know, I mean, that's, I think that's a big thing too. For me is having Ara can be like, she's like the brightest spot in this world, you know, in a way, even though she's still kind of making her way through it and figuring out who she is. Like she's her internal compass. Again, going back to the internal compass, her internal compass is solid, and kind of instilling that in your kids, I think is important. And I think that's what, I think that's what a lot of times what we try to find in religion is, at least from my standpoint, the thing that I am drawn to the most from religion, other than the sense of community and family, which is great. But most importantly, I think, is that sense of that internal compass in the sense of right from wrong and morality and how to treat people and how to treat yourself and live with respect and love and integrity. And I think that to me, that's what Ara is trying to do in a world that's way, you know, way behind the times in terms of those things.
Yeah, she is very, like you said, she just has that strong moral compass. And in a way, you can see her as she interacts with people, especially those that are a bit downtrodden. She's kind of inspiring to them, as opposed to Torrenthal, who, I mean, let's talk a little bit about him and the challenge of writing villains.
Yeah, again, Torrenthal is... Torrenthal can come across as it's funny. Torrenthal, if you just read it, probably comes across as a little one-dimensional. But it's because his arc is really long. And actually, again, touching upon what we're going into with the third arc, you're going to learn a lot about him in the third arc and his motivation. And it cuts to the core. And that's always the biggest trick. With villains, it's always about their motivation. And that's the, you know, the villains live and die by their motivation. And if they don't have one that's legitimate and realistic and that makes sense, like they become cartoon characters no matter what you're writing or what, you know, what medium you're working in. And so I think that that once this third volume is done, it's going to help kind of flesh him out a lot more. But yes, he's definitely presented as kind of the just straight up bad guy in the first volume. But again, I think in the third volume, you're going to see at least some rationale for why that is, and be kind of a jerk.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at a character and he has all these, you know, unredeemable qualities, and if you have no point of reference, then you have a hard time relating to him. But like you said, it all goes back to motivation. So if we find out, you know, something terrible happened to him in his past, and then all of a sudden, as a reader, you put yourself in that situation and you start asking yourself, well, how would I react or what would I have done? Right. And I think that's the touch point, right? That's what makes it interesting.
And that's what you're going to see a little bit in the third volume, you know, but we had to get to this point because, like I said, this is kind of, things are coming to a head. And so you kind of needed that. And also you want to be careful. And also with the way these stories are kind of structured, like it's interesting. Like I love being able to have the volumes as we do with the beginning, middle, and an end. And whether it's a 5 or 6 issues with a book like Journey or 8 issues normally with a book like Soulfire, they work really well in a certain respect. But the one thing that they don't lend themselves to, which is unfortunate, is kind of these quieter issues where you can really delve into a character for like the whole issue.
Right.
It's kind of like the, you know, growing up reading X-Men, like I love all the big X-Men stories and I read X-Men for 2-3 decades or whatever. I'm aging myself really bad right now, but I don't care. And you know, tons of great and just phenomenal storylines, Dark Phoenix Saga and the Marvel Mutant Massacre and, you know, Fall of the Mutants and Apocalypse and all that sort of stuff. And yet some of my favorite issues are the ones where they were like this, what I call the softball issues. You know, there are always issues every now and then, like once every couple of years where they played a game of softball together and they're just hanging out. And like, cause that's where you really got to know the characters and they kind of had that downtime. And it was more about the, the soap opera-ness of the characters and their relationships with one another than it was about destroying or defeating a bad guy. And I feel like when you're doing books in volumes like we do at Aspen, they don't really allow themselves. Like I wouldn't feel I could take like in a 5-issue round of Journey, I don't have the space to like take a whole issue and say, okay, this, we're just going to, you know, tell this one little side story, right, diving into this character more fully so you can kind of really paint a big picture of them. And that's unfortunate, you know, I mean, that's the nature of the beast. And so you do what you can. So, but I think had that been the case, if Journey would have been like an ongoing, I probably would have had an issue that focused on Tarnthal already to help kind of lay some of this groundwork. But that's, again, that's something that I'm going to be talking about and showcasing in the third volume.
So let's talk just real quick about the setting, the world. We've talked about how brutal it is, how kind of, you know, women aren't treated well, and it's blood and steel. And you know, you're delving into a lot of the myths and the folklore of the Middle East. When you were conceiving the story, was that all right in the DNA from the beginning?
Well, I think from the harshness of the world, absolutely, because that's what makes the story work with Aro. That's what gives Aro the thing to kind of stand against, right? You know, it's like you need, in a way, Tarnthal is a reflection of the world, and she is standing up against the world, the right, world of violence and injustice and inhumanity. And so that's the true villain, if you want. But there's also some truly wondrous things, you know, not everybody's a monster in it. And sometimes even the monsters aren't that monstrous in the stereotypical sense. But it is a harsh world. And I feel like that's partially a necessity of the fantasy genre in order to have these big grand adventures, but also like to have the stakes be what they are. You know, I can't really put her in a situation where, like, I don't know what you would do putting her in a situation if she came upon Camelot. Like, what's that, you know, what's that world for her? You know, like, right, if she came on Camelot and met King Arthur, and he's a just king and everything's fine, and you know, it's all cool, and maybe there's someone to fight, but we'll take care of it because that's what we do. And so I feel like the world has to be stacked against her in that regard, and she's constantly forced to make these decisions. And you know, and not to spoil it, but in the second volume, for instance, you know, she has a decision to make at one point where it's her quest or helping somebody out, and she chooses the latter because she feels compelled to, even though knowing that it's going to delay, you know, her, you know, delay her in her search for her mother. But it's, you know, she can't ignore it. So it is a matter of kind of presenting her not only with these dilemmas at every turn, but also these threats at every turn. And so you can't really have these dilemmas and these threats if the world was a really peaceful world. And let's face it, there's a lot less sword fighting in peaceful stories. So if you can't, you know, you can't have the sword fighting, I mean, what are we doing?
All right. Well, JT, it's always great, man. I love talking to you, as you know. So anytime you want to come back on and talk more about Soulfire or Journey, love to have you back on. Why don't you let our listeners know what some of the other upcoming projects that you can talk about or other things you have on the stands that they should be looking out for?
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I love talking with you. I appreciate that you enjoy the stories that I write, and thanks for having me on to help kind of spread the word, because that means a lot to me. And again, more importantly, I'm just glad you like the stuff. So I hope you keep enjoying what you check out. It's a pretty big year for me. It's Aspen's 15th anniversary, and so I have a handful of projects with them. Journey, like we've talked about, that's out right now. Issue 2 comes out next week. In Free Comic Book Day, I'm really excited. I actually have a new creator book working with these two producers, Yu-Yun Song and Dina Wu. And we created this project called New Way, which is kind of a futuristic adventure about a arena professional MMA type fighter living in this future city in China that's like the new, like, you know, New York City megapolis, and just kind of struggling with this notion of cybernetic fighters and kind of trying to carve his path. So it's kind of a gritty, darker world, and he's kind of trying to find his way. So it's a science fiction and adventure story, action thriller. And that, so that actually premieres in Free Comic Book Day in May, which I'm really excited that Aspen, let us use half the book for, to premiere that. And then the first issue will premiere in July and we'll launch at Comic-Con. And then also at Comic-Con in July, it's the 15th anniversary of Aspen. So it's the 15th anniversary of Soulfire. And we have, a whole new volume coming out, and it's the beginning of a huge kind of, a huge arc and a huge kind of next evolution of the book. I've written more Soulfire than I've written anything else in my life. It's the, you know, it's such a dear project to me and property, and being able to have worked on it for so long and kind of being able to continue on and having Aspen keep me with it. And I've been able to create a lot in the world of Soulfire, and we're actually going to be kind of taking that to even greater heights here coming up. So I'm really excited about that. And then in the fall, working with Vince Hernandez and this new artist, Romina Morinelli, we have this new book called Artifact One coming out, which they just announced. They just released the preview, the promo image for it. And I can't really say much about it, but it's something I'm really excited about. It's a very different type of book in a way. And it's, the stuff's looking fantastic. We're getting art already for the Zero issue, and she's just an unbelievable talent. And the book just really just kind of is going to jump off the page. And then I have one other book that they haven't announced yet. That's another Aspen, connected property that's, slated to come out in the later part of this year. So, yeah, so I've got a lot of stuff coming out. And I hope people can check it out, and I hope they like the stuff. And Aspen's been working really hard these last few years trying to get the trade library up. So for people who haven't checked out stuff, like, they're pretty much caught up on all the volumes of Soulfire, and Mindfield Volume 1 came out in trade paperback, and we already have both volumes of Journey out in trade paperback. So that's all exciting for people who haven't read the stuff before and want to get in on the ground floor and check things out. Like, it's never been easier, for them to do so. And I'm getting ready. I'm going to Calgary Expo next week, so I'm excited about that, because I was bummed I missed you at WonderCon. Yeah, that was unfortunate. Yeah.
Glad you're feeling better.
But I'm looking forward to Calgary, and I'm going to be doing a handful of other conventions throughout the summer and into the fall too. So,
wow, that sounds like you do have a full year. I'm excited to get to read all these new projects and have more J.T. Kroll books to read. And, you know, exciting times for Aspen too, with the deal that you guys signed. You know, Frank was on about a month ago talking about that. So that's really exciting. And it definitely sounds like, you know, I've kind of gotten away from doing too many interviews, at conventions, just because, it's so crowded and we're all so busy. And I like doing it like this, where we get to delve into a little more. So, I agree.
I think these are a lot more interesting. Like, I think for us, but also I think for the listener too, I think that, getting a little more in depth than just like the kind of the elevator pitch and a couple of questions here and there.
Yeah, exactly.
So absolutely.
So that being said, we'll have to get together at San Diego Comic-Con, and once the new book has debuted, the first issue in July, as you said, and the Soulfire, and have you on sometime then. And
that'd be great. I'd love to do that. That's awesome. I always like to talk anytime, Jace.
Yeah, and the other thing that I really want to have you on one of these days is that Captain Atom book, man. I just think that it's such a, you were doing so many interesting things with that. So to sit down and even if it's not for the show, we'll just go have a drink and talk about.
Yeah. That yeah. Book. No, absolutely. That was working with Freddie Williams was fantastic. And he's such a cool guy. And it was a real, we got connected early on that project. And so we really did kind of build the book together. Because a lot of times you get on books and it's like, oh, you're going to write it, and then we don't know who the artist is, but let's figure out stories and whatnot. And with that book in particular, they approached us both early on. They kind of paired us up, and we had only met socially at a convention a couple of times. Then we had like a dinner together one time with like a dinner of like, you know, 20 people, and I got to know him a little bit. He's so nice and so talented.
Yep.
And we got it. Like, we got what we were trying to do. And we were on the same page, and it wasn't like we were finishing each other's sentences, but like everything we thought of, we built on each other. to build this stuff up. And I swear to God, like every issue, the actual writing of every issue was super easy. Cause what would happen is we would have like a 3-hour conversation on the phone. We would talk about the entire issue. And then I'd basically just go and write down what we talked about. And it was so
awesome.
Yeah. And I loved it. The book turned out, and I was really bummed that it didn't connect and didn't find its readership. I didn't know if I expected it to, because A, it was such a different type of book. It wasn't a superhero book. It was more of just like the straight up, like hard science fiction tale. And also with the new 52, you know, every book was getting relaunched. So there was really so little oxygen in the room for something.
Yep, I think that's to
really hit. And that was unfortunate, but they gave, you know, to the credit, they gave us a year, you know, we got to do 12 issues and the zero issue. And I appreciate that, man, more than, you know, like I'm really proud of that book. And I bought a couple of pages from Freddie that I have in my collection. I don't have a lot of art, but I every now and then I collect a piece just because I just really want to kind of have a marker of certain things I've worked on. And he's just tremendous. He's a super, super, super big fan. And he just announced he's doing like He-Man versus Injustice. Did you see that?
I saw that
today. This killer promo image. Oh my God. Like, it's so cool.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. Yeah, I remember loving the series so much when it first came out. And then I just reread it recently when DC put out that 6-issue miniseries of Captain Man. It was okay. I was like, but you know what? This makes me want to go read the good one. I reread and I thought the same thing. I was like, you know, if this hadn't launched with, you know, 51 other books, maybe it would have had a better shot. But
yeah, yeah. But you know, it is what it is. I mean, yeah. you do what you can do, and we write the stories we can write, and we, you know, when, if they connect, they connect, and if they don't, they don't. You just kind of keep plugging away and you know, try to keep on keeping on.
Yeah, at least you know there are some Captain Atom fans out there of your fans.
Yes,
of
yes, that run, so yes, that's important. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. So, but thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Sure. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners, JT?
No, I think I'm good. That's a lot. I'm trying to keep my head on straight with all these different projects around from one to the other. But I really just, again, like I'm really excited for Aspen, the 15th anniversary, and like the announcement that you said, and partnering up with Mythos Entertainment. And I'm hoping it means that sooner than later, there'll be other things that are coming down the pike that'll help kind of put a spotlight on Aspen. They're a great bunch of guys. They've been like family to me since I got in this business, and they're actually a big reason why I'm still able to do comic books. I mean, they really did kind of give me a home early on, and it's been that way. And we've been through a lot, and losing Mike was just horrendous in every way imaginable. But the fact that the company's still going here, you know, at the 15th year mark, like I think you'd be really happy about that. And, you know, touching upon Journey for just a second, like the whole 10 for 10 initiative for the 10th anniversary, like part of Journey and the reason it happened then was because I was thinking about like, well, what kind of book would excite Mike? Like, what would he have wanted? And so as I was coming up with the ideas for it, I thought like, oh, he would love this. And like, I could imagine what his covers would be like. And if he did interiors or whatever, what it'd be like. And so like this capturing the spirit of what he tried to put in his books was something that kind of was part of like the recipe, if you will, of Journey. So,
Not a doubt in my mind, he would have loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I want to thank you for your time, JT. Do you want to share with our listeners where they can follow you on social media so they know when all these hundreds of projects you got are coming?
I'm just on Twitter, JT Krule. So that's the best place to find me. That's kind of where I can't, my brain can't handle more than one social media site. That's kind of where I am.
I'll put a link in the show notes, listeners, so you can click there, go to JT's Twitter and give him a follow. That way you'll know when the announcements are made and when the books are coming out. So
cool.
Once again,
thanks, man.
I want to thank you all for joining us. Don't forget, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. And speaking of Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great to find out when we release new episodes and follow our convention coverage. Also, I should mention it, if you go over to LRM Online to check out past episodes of the podcast, be sure you check out all their other pop culture coverage on movies, TV shows, all that kind of great stuff. So thanks for joining me, JT.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, man.
And we'll talk to you guys next time.
Later.